From Raleigh to Washington, another hectic week. We are just 33 days away from Election Day. Glad to have you along. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. It is a Friday. That means, among other things, it is time to get caught up on some of what happened this week in state politics. Back for our review are Becky Gray from the Conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch.
Hi, pleasure to be with you.
We're recording Friday morning. President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump have tested positive for coronavirus. The massive news came overnight via, of course, a tweet. The couple is quarantining and apparently feeling well. Your perspectives on how this may or may not change the final month of the race here in North Carolina. Rob?
Well, I mean, I have to say that it seems as if it's sort of the final chapter and really an sort of this utterly chaotic presidency. You know, from the beginning, Trump has sort of shown us both how not to respond to a health pandemic, both from a personal and a governing perspective. And it seems like, you know, this is just the final chapter in that. I don't know. I mean, I've seen all kinds of reactions. We're still in the early hours of this. We're still in the early hours of this development. But it seems as if there's some people who actually didn't even believe it initially, thought it might be phony. There were other people who have, you know, thought there was some sort of karma there, that after all of his defiance of common sense when it came to public health, there are people who are very worried that he could have conceivably infected Vice President Biden during the debate. But the bottom line is, it seems to me it takes him, if it looks like he has symptoms, so it's going to take him out of what he's been doing for at least a couple of weeks. And so at least we know there won't be, you know, more in-person rallies taking place in North Carolina. Again, from looking at the polls, I suspect we're at the point where it's really just about everybody knows where they stand on Donald Trump. And so I don't think it's going to have a big impact, but I don't see how it could help him very much.
Well, I think, you know, Jeff, in answer to your question about, you know, will it change things here in North Carolina? You know, what we're seeing, and of course, you know, this is new news Friday morning, but, you know, what we're seeing is people extending well wishes, thoughts and prayers for the president and the first lady. Vice President Biden and Jill Biden have come out with a statement. Some of the left-leaning news media have come out with well wishes for the president. So I think in my mind, if we can hope for any changes, not just here in North Carolina, but across the country, that maybe we'll have a different tone for the rest of the election, of recognizing that this pandemic has affected all of us, you know, at every level in differing degrees. But, you know, we really are, I mean, not to, you know, get too much in the cliches and all, but, you know, if it's a reminder that we are all in this together and no one is immune from the effects of it. And if that leads to less harshness for the next month and a half until we get through the election, I think that'll be extremely healthy. We could use a dose of that in the country, particularly after the, you know, we saw the debate, the presidential debates, and we could certainly use it here in North Carolina as well. So my hope would be that, you know, if there is a change, if this affects the election, that it leads to, you know, more of a recognition that we really are all Americans, we're all facing this together, and, you know, we're all in this together.
I guess the only other thing I would say is that, I mean, what's of course unspoken is that we don't know how serious this will be for him. We hope very much that it won't be, but I mean, there is the chance that this could debilitate him, cause him not to be able, not just to run for president, but to serve as president for a while. So we're in uncharted waters here. This is an amazing, disturbing development and just the latest in all, you know, what seems like an endless series of them throughout the year 2020.
Becky, my job is to listen as much as it is anything else, and the tone of your voice sounds different to me today, and I don't know if that's because it's the morning. You sound like you're done with 2020.
You know, I am done with 2020, and, you know, just looking back over the week that we've had, and it's like every week continues to get even more chaotic, and, you know, just when you think, okay, maybe things have settled down a little bit, maybe we can, you know, at least catch our breath. Jeff, you mentioned, you know, what's a weekend? Well, I think for those of us that do this, you know, if there's a message coming out of 2020, it's, you know, we've lost our weekends. So, yeah, you know, a good observation and probably pretty accurate.
All right. To that point, perhaps, it was just 3 days ago. I think it feels like about 3 weeks. It was just 3 days ago that the president and Democratic nominee Joe Biden shared a debate stage, although there wasn't really much debate. A chaotic and at times embarrassing forum in which Trump frequently interrupted his competitor and moderator Chris Wallace was unable to offer very much help. Tell me one specific improvement that must be made prior to the next debate on October 15th, presuming there is a next debate on October 15th. Becky?
I think that whoever moderates it has to really get control of it. You know, Chris Wallace lost control of the debate. Now, he was dealing with two, you know, rabid alligators, if you will, during that debate. But I think that the moderator, and I understand that the commission that oversees these debates is looking at changing the rules and the format of the debate to get a better grip on it. But I'm not sure that that the debate, I blame everybody. You know, to be honest with you with that. Interestingly enough, I was watching the debate with my grandchildren, and about 10 minutes into it, they looked at me and said, this is like two kindergartners having a big fight. So, I mean, even children recognized, you know, what this was.
Brief follow-up, and I don't disagree that blame can be put in different places. I mean, to be fair, Joe Biden told the president of the United States to shut up at one point. Told him he was the worst president ever. But are we all in agreement here that President Trump was more juvenile in his actions Tuesday night than Vice President Biden? Would you agree with that, Becky?
I think they were, to be honest with you, I think they were equally childish.
I think the number of times, I think it's been shown that the number of times that Trump interrupted Biden, even when he was talking about his deceased son, way exceeded what Biden did. I think what this debate proved, I don't think there's anything we can do to change the rules so long as Donald Trump is part of the debates, assuming that he recovers and he's part of additional debates. It is impossible to have a civilized debate with a narcissist like Trump about policy and principles. The only option, and I think, frankly, this is Joe Biden's, to his credit, he has recognized, I think like a lot of the other Democratic candidates maybe couldn't have figured out a way, the only way he's going to actually take on Trump and that he's going to be rooted out of the White House is through essentially political hand-to-hand combat. He's taking him on his own turf and wrestling with him, and it's ugly and it makes you want to avert your eyes. It's kind of like the end of a war, but that's what it's going to take. I think it's the only way there's no soaring rhetoric or ideological policy debate that's going to happen with Donald Trump. This is the only way to take him on. Otherwise, he's just going to completely dominate things unless you give it as well as you get it.
I'm going to timestamp it real quick. It's 10:13 Friday morning. The New York Times is now reporting that the president is showing mild symptoms of coronavirus, if you hadn't seen that. But I just mentioned that as that's probably going to make it into the longer podcast cut of our conversation. We're going to move from the timestamp to the rubber stamp, which was last night. The third and final U.S. Senate debate in our state took place. It was a reminder of, to me, what decorum, decency, and yes, debate can still actually look like. Plenty of personal, though seemingly civil, attacks. Republican Tom Tillis, the incumbent, Democrat Cal Cunningham. Did either say anything that you thought might potentially move voters to or away from their camp?
I don't think so. First of all, I'm curious as to what the ratings are for this, as to whether really at this point many people are paying much attention unless they're just political junkies like us. To me, from the beginning, I've said this to the point where I'm sure people are sick of hearing it. Trump is the issue. He's always been the issue. Tillis is plagued by Trump. He can't live with him. He can't live without him. And this is the risk that the Republican Party took when they embraced Trump. Trump is the overriding issue in this debate. All the other issues of pandemic, healthcare, access to healthcare, all those things feed from Trump. And the notion that, you know, they both were accusing each other of they're going to vote with their party most of the time. It's like, duh, that's really surprising that senators are going to vote with their party most of the time. And for Tillis to call Cunningham a rubber stamp was really sort of amusing. So Tillis is in a tough spot. As I've said from the beginning, he has aligned himself with Trump. He is burdened by that. And I think Cunningham's just trying to run out the clock at this point.
Well, I think several differences. First of all, this was the third time that we had seen a debate between Tillis and Cunningham, so we kind of knew what the tone was going to be like. I don't think that there were any surprises there. If there was one description of the debate, I think, you know, as we all recognize, it would have been rubber stamp. And a couple things stood out to me with that is, one, that reiterated how important and how critical North Carolina is to the national party, to the national, the makeup of the Senate. The results of this election could very well determine who controls the Senate. And so the strings attached to the national party and the national leadership, Rob has talked about the ties between Trump and Tillis. I think the ties are equally there between Schumer, between the National Democratic Party, between Joe Biden and Cunningham. So one thing that struck me in the debate is I didn't hear a lot of talk about North Carolina's specific issues. What either one of them would do for or with North Carolinians, it was that higher level discussion of how are they going to react to the national parties and the national leadership. And, you know, I mean, I think what voters should have gotten out of it was that, you know, with a Tillis vote, it will be tied to the national Republican leadership, whether that's McConnell or whether that's Trump. And with Cunningham, you get that that verification and that tie to the Democratic Party. So I think that's kind of what I heard on that. I think, too, the thing that is astounding to me is the amount of money that is being spent in that race. I think by the time this is all over and we do all those tabulations, this may be the most expensive Senate race in the country and maybe a record that we have now. So the attention that's being paid to this race from across the country, and again, the national ties to it, I think that speaks to that as well.
You mentioned the huge sums of money. I think that does underscore that the stakes are high, that this may very well be the 50th or the 51st seat for whichever party wins. So whoever wins here, Cunningham or Tillis, that's going to be seat 50 or 51 for either the Republicans maintaining power or the Democrats. When Tillis ran 6 years ago and knocked off Kay Hagan, that was at the time it became the most expensive U.S. Senate race in history. And based on some of the conversations I've had, Becky, I imagine you're having similar conversations, the spending in this race could reach $250 million when all is said and done, which is it's just astronomical. So the fight over mail-in ballot rules continues. Last week, the State Board of Elections reached what it announced was a settlement with plaintiffs in several different lawsuits about absentee mail-in guidelines. However, that resulted in two Republican board members who had initially supported those changes, then resigning in protest. That was after pressure from party leaders. Now, Republicans are challenging this compromise in court, state and federal. This week, a federal judge criticized the Board of Elections for circumventing the legislative process. A day later, Thursday, the State Board changed back some of the mail-in ballot rules, at least until this gets sorted out in the courts. A little chaotic, to say the least. Rob, the board, which is controlled by Democrats, overplayed its hand here, did it not?
I don't see how they did. I mean, it was a unanimous vote of Democrats and Republicans on the board. It was a common sense, some simple changes. Look, we're in an unprecedented pandemic. We're in an enormous crisis. People are voting in vast numbers by mail for the first time. Many, many people, it's the first time they've had a chance to do it. The notion simply that we would give people the chance to verify that, oh, I screwed up, I didn't do that right, and sign an affidavit, and that we would allow a little more time to count these ballots seemed like pretty modest, simple changes. So I don't think they overplayed their hand. I think it's entirely possible that once all this court debate is settles out, that those will be the rules that will apply. The bottom line ought to be that we ought to be looking for as many possible ways for people to get their votes counted, to vote during this pandemic, people who are fearful of coming out. And frankly, for years, the Republicans were the ones, when they were the ones doing most of the absentee ballot voting in a different era, had no concerns about absentee ballots. They were trying to suppress the vote at the actual polling places. now that it looks like a lot of Democrats, a lot of lower income people, people of color who didn't traditionally vote through absentee ballots are making use of it, all of a sudden there's grave concern about voter fraud, which is preposterous. It's not been a problem. It's not going to be a problem. We have one of the safest, best voting systems in the world. I really don't think at all they overplayed their hand. I think those are precisely the kind of changes we should have been making.
With all due respect, I think Rob kind of misses the point on this. The point is not, whether or not there need to be protections. Of course there does. The point on this is there were protections that were put into law that were passed with strong bipartisan support of both the House and the Senate. The General Assembly is the entity that makes these laws, that control these things. That bill went to the governor. He signed it the next day after it hit his desk. There were laws in place. There are laws in place that do these things, that ensure that every vote count, that protect against ballot harvesting, that protect the integrity of the votes. What the State Board of Elections did, and with this settlement and the other things, is they circumvented the General Assembly and the governor and the written law that was in place. Now, if there's changes that need to be made, as Rob suggests, that needs to be made through the process of lawmaking that is clearly defined in our state constitution, in the U.S. Constitution, and so the problem with this was that, yes, the State Board of Elections way overreached on theirs. We need to go back to the law as it is written, as it was passed, not through a settlement, not through rules adopted by an unelected State Board of Elections, not through a big-time Democratic operative that's come into North Carolina to do these things. We need to go back to the law as it was written.
Legislatures and governors sign and pass and put into place unconstitutional laws all the time that infringe on people's rights. And there are lawsuits brought to challenge that. And it happens all the time that lawsuits are settled to remedy the fact that laws were flawed, that they were passed in an unconstitutional, had an unconstitutional impact. This is a classic example of that.
And you know, what we have now is we have a couple lawsuits that are working their way through the state courts. We have at least two lawsuits that are working their way through the federal courts. What we're hearing from the federal judges already is that, you know, a pretty strong order condemning what the State Board of Elections did with this settlement. All of these things are being expedited. So, again, kind of going back, Jeff, to your comments earlier about how quickly things are changing. I think this is one that's going to be very fast moving. It has to be because the election is underway. You can't change the rules of the game in the middle of an election.
Well, you can clearly give people more time to vote. We can have more time to cure flawed ballots, ballots that may have a stupid mistake that someone has made, forgot to put in a signature or signed it in the wrong place. Sure you can. It happens all the time. We order polling places to stay open past the hours that they were originally set. Judges and courts get involved all the time to make adjustments to make sure that everybody gets a chance to vote. This will get sorted out in the courts. I hope very much that the courts err on the side of letting as many people vote as possible. And I really don't think it's ultimately going to be that big of a deal.
I think it's a big deal. You know, as of this morning, again, Friday morning, 317,000 people had already cast their vote. So we are in the middle of, you know, with this absentee ballot process that we have, we are already in the middle of an election. The rules were set, the law was set before this started, and that's what we need to rely on with this. So we'll see, I mean, we're going to sort this out through the courts, it looks like.
And across the country, there are now more than 200 lawsuits dealing with various rules and regulations around voting, specifically largely mail-in balloting. So unfortunately, I think we probably can all agree that some races, hopefully not here in North Carolina, hopefully not the presidential race, but some races may very well not be clear on November 3rd and may not be clear for weeks because of this ongoing litigation and many of these questions. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy your weekend.
Okay, you too.
Take care. Bye-bye.
If you've yet to locate it, a voter guide comprised by my colleagues Rusty Jacobs and Mitch Northam is available at our website, WUNC.org. Previous episodes of the Politics Podcast there, as well as on iTunes and Google Play. And you can find all sorts of context and reporting. There was a recent U.S. Senate debate just last night, Thursday. And also, we've got a new web post up about some of the battleground districts in the North Carolina Senate races. So check those out again at the website or follow along the many podcast offerings that WUNC has as well. As always, thanks for listening. We'll be back with you in your podcast feeds next week when we drop an episode about competitive North Carolina House races. For Becky and Rob, I'm Jeff. Enjoy that weekend. Thank you.